Good morning, everybody, and I want to welcome everyone to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee here today. Today is March 19th. I'd like to see that there's a quorum present. Vice Chair Mecklen, have you had a chance to look over March 18th's minutes from yesterday?
I have, and I move the minutes.
Minutes have been moved from yesterday, March 18th. Members, any questions, concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes have been passed. Thank you again for being here this morning. Today, members, we've got a few bills in front of us, and I again promise to come back to our early discussion about House File 1976, which was my bill. Mr. Co-Chair, I was just going to sit from here and just discuss it at this point, if that's all right. No testifying today, but just here to answer some questions. And sorry, Co-Chair, you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so and no problem at all with that. I don't actually see the bill in the materials, and I guess I thought that was going to be the case, but perhaps not.
I apologize. Because it was a continuation that maybe members would have saved it. How do you want to proceed? Is it okay to move forward?
No, I think that's probably fine. I'll look to see if members and I think Representative Frazier is going to do the bulk of the questioning. And maybe I'll note, Mr. Chair, while we'll have the opportunity to speak. You and I have spoken before, and I think in our members, the plan is we've got just about 30 minutes of questions, no more than that. I know you've scheduled a number of bills, including in consultation with me. I really appreciate, and so that's the plan. I think Representative Frazier will do most of the questioning. Looks like he's ready for that, so we can dive on in. So just want to make sure, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto, as well. So with that, I think I just want to maybe just kind of get our heads around it. I'll make a little bit of an opening statement, and then again, from the list we had was Representative Frazier, Representative Berg, and then Representative Wayne Johnson. If you remember what you want to talk about, if you are ready to do that, that's what the list was when we left it last Thursday. So again, members, I just want to say thanks again for hearing House File 1976 last week, and to continue the conversation about, again, today about roughly 30 minutes to try to get House File 1976 better understood by any member that's here. Again, I've mentioned my bill is not the bill. It's not the perfect bill. Of course, it has to get out of here, and I don't have any illusions that we are going to do anything other than just try to modify what I believe needs to be done with House File 2 from last session. As a refresher, again, my bill would provide 6 weeks of paid leave to small businesses with 50 employees or less, a generous benefit for employees at businesses at this size. This along with having large employers at 12 weeks of paid leave. Again, will help lower the cost of the tax and the program costs while still providing meaningful leave. Doing this will keep the premium for the program closer to the intended mark of 0.7 when it was first released back in 2003. So as we lay this bill over again, I invite any members, DFL, GOP, small unions, small businesses, union organizers, nonprofits, just anyone who has other thoughts to this, I'm open and willing to talk about anything that you want to talk about when it comes to paid family medical leave. I want and need everyone's feedback if we're going to make a difference on this important issue. Again, last Thursday provided some really good, meaningful information. I think it was Representative Frazier that brought up the 50-50 question about the legality of the federal side. I could be wrong on that, but I wanted to make sure we got that right. I don't have an amendment to bring today, but I am working on that question to make sure that if we don't allow unions to be able to negotiate that 50-50 split, I want to make sure that we're doing it by the law. So I'm working on those kind of issues, and should this come forward, we will have a better, cleaner plan for that. By the time we wrap up our committee work this session, members, we either need to make significant enhancements to House File 2 from 2024, or we need to seriously get ready to delay the program if we can't get something to put together. I do hope that we've got some good time to sit down and talk about this. I have had a couple of members start reaching over to talk about some ideas, so I appreciate that. And with that, members, I'll just put it back out then to Representative Frazier for sort of any further thoughts that you have on 1976. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate that you're engaging in a manner that is trying to bring in as many voices as possible. I think that's important, and I think your last comment about the negotiation piece on a 50-50, we can talk more about that, but it was a great segue, because my first question is about your bill would exclude workers under collective bargaining agreements until they negotiate to opt in to the paid family leave program. And I guess my question is, did labor groups ask you for that provision?
Representative Frazier, they didn't specifically ask for that provision. It was built on the prior conversations I've had with many union members, not maybe necessarily the leadership. Well, no, it was some leadership of the unions that had earlier said, we didn't really ask for this because if it would have been important to us, it would have been at the collective bargaining table. And I quote unquote those different comments. It wasn't anything recently that they've asked me for that, Representative Frazier.
Did any employers ask for it?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Frazier, they did.
All right. And can you state the reason that the employers thought this would be a good idea to disadvantage unions from being into this paid family program?
Representative Frazier, I don't know. They didn't give me a lot of the feedback behind it. I think, as I would anticipate, it was making sure that the robust benefits that they feel they're offering now would just be more complicated and compounded if they were 100% paid for then by whether it's retailers or whatever it might be to just put too much pressure on that business or whatever. So I think they were just looking for maybe it was just a way to not have that major issue on top of their regular negotiating things that they do every couple years to just not want to deal with that. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the point is, I mean, with this being kind of the intent of this was to be a universal kind of floor for all workers if you're employed, if you meet the eligibility criteria. So I can't quite wrap my head around this idea to be a major bargaining issue if it's a program that's going to be applied to every employer in the state as it currently stands in the law right now. But what I do know and what I am concerned with is that if you are excluding a whole swath of people, folks that are unionized in collective bargaining agreements, and they have to negotiate that, my concern is that we won't have that universal floor that we were looking for, because you could have situations where they just don't come to an agreement on this. Therefore, they are excluded for a long period of time, or they are excluded in perpetuity, and that is a big concern. And I'll just say this off the top, one of the things as I was working through this last night is, with many of the provisions that you have, it really can exclude many folks from either accessing it, from the exclusion of labor unions, or some of the provisions that lessen the amount of lead time that you get in the 67 flat rate. I'm really wondering what it starts to appear to me is a larger concern is that if we've got individuals, swaths of individuals that are excluded, if we've got swaths of individuals that may be impacted by the 67 flat rate percentage, meaning they're going to get less wage replacement, we could have large swaths of people that just cannot access this or will not access this because financially it doesn't make sense. And then I guess the question is that the idea? Because then that would actually kill this program.
Representative Frazier, everything you mentioned is actually all negotiable. If you really hate the 67 idea of the two-thirds pay, that's okay to talk about. If the 50-50 split is something that just isn't workable, I think what I plan to do is to visit with a number of the unions that want to sit down and talk to me about what does this look like from your end. I have not sat in collective bargaining for 30 years when I lived up in International Falls when I was at the table in management for a hotel. I've been there. I know what some of that's like, but also today is much, much different. I am hoping I can visit with some of those members to just talk about what are your real pinch points here. No one is going to get excluded. My idea is no one gets excluded without their sitting down and at least having that conversation. It was a choice. If they want to be included, looking at their current benefit set, do you guys want to talk about maybe different pay, different pension options? But it gave the unions, for example, an option. Is this what you want to have part of the current negotiating process? That was the intent of that, Representative Frazier, not to exclude, but that was the intent of my bill.
Thank you for that clarification, because the way it reads now, you would need bilateral agreement for unions to be opted in. So that's an exclusion. unless the employer agrees and the union agrees. And if the employer kind of digs its heels in, and specifically for the examples you gave, some employers just don't want to deal with this major part at the table, which I don't consider to be a major part because it's a statewide program, that could lead to an actual exclusion, because if employers dig in and say, well, you know what, we just don't think this is a good idea first, we think you have appropriate leave time now, so we're going to stick with what we have, then you would have individuals that would be totally excluded from the program. And I think that's one of my major concerns, and that's one of labor's major concerns about this. And I also would, just to the point of conversations, I mean, many of the labor organizations have testified throughout the process before we passed this bill and currently now in defense of the law that's currently going to start to take effect in January 1st, 2026. So I think we could take into account what they're testifying to now, and many of them really want this program to go into effect as kind of a floor for every Minnesota, not just for those under collective bargaining agreements. I just wanted to put that out there. And then my next question was around you want to expand a seasonal employee exemption. Can you talk more about how you went from 150 days, which I think is pretty generous now, to 180 days would be kind of like up to a half a year, and call that seasonal?
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Again, my intention there is most seasonal businesses are open more than 150 days in a year. Again, being in the business myself, we have a business called Green Lake Cruises. We're open from about mid-May through the end of September. We sometimes run into October, and it would run out of some of those days. Again, I think just naturally 6 months on, 6 months off is what I would consider seasonal. I have heard from Hospitality Minnesota, other industries like that just say, gee, that's – they recognized and appreciated the 150. It was a recognition. But when in reality, when they start looking at the actual days in a calendar, what days can be open – they're really needing a little bit of a broader window, and that was the intent, and that's where that came from, Representative Frazier.
So what do we think? Do we have concerns about the individuals? And many of these seasonal jobs, I mean, these are tough jobs, high-risk jobs. They're already not high wages. If an individual gets injured and needs to take the time that they would need to take care of themselves, is there no concern that those individuals will be excluded from this program?
I think, Representative Frazier, currently what they're doing now is they're working with with employees like I do. If somebody is out having leave, medical situations, they'll have maybe 3-4 weeks off at a time for different reasons. It's not to say we would say no. Employers care about these people. We want them to come back. We want the flexibility. But in a seasonal business, if they're all of a sudden going to be taking 12 weeks off during the heart of the season, that, for those types of businesses, are going to be much, much more challenging than a business that might be open 12 months out of the year, where they don't have the high sales, very roller coaster kind of income, because when it's all in, you're all in, and in the summer months. So that was the intent of that, Representative Frazier.
And Chair Baker, thank you. I do appreciate that, and I've heard that often in this conversation, is that if someone needs to take 12 weeks off, but I mean, it's not a vacation. This is someone that's actually injured, or they need to help take care of someone that is injured or sick in a manner that they can't take care of themselves. So it's not a vacation, and this would be a necessary need to take time off, not to go and take a cruise or take a vacation somewhere. And so I really get concerned about that framing of it, is that this is some individual just says, hey, I need some time off to take a break. I'm going to access paid family medical leave. One, they wouldn't qualify. Two, if they did qualify, it's really something kind of catastrophic, and they need to take the time off, which is what the bill is intended for. So I just want to make sure we're thinking about those things. One of the other things that your bill would do would allow for a third party administration of the claims. And I guess the question is, was that something that the department requested? Did DEED request that?
Representative Frazier, no, they did not. That came to me, I think I mentioned that in testimony, from other states that have been very successfully utilizing a private company that has run the call centers, ran a lot of the components of it, but the state, because it was still a state mandated program, included a payroll tax just like Minnesota, but they were hired to do a job. It was an RFP that had to be competitively done. They were being very successful at it. I think there was some good customer feedback scores about the checks are getting out. And again, when folks do this all the time, that's all they do. Sometimes they do it better than government officials. And so, no, the DEED did not bring that idea to me. They're not requesting it. I wanted to have it as an option if they felt that that was best for the program. Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things, I mean, coincidentally, when you raised this during the last session, many of us went to the website of the one state that does do the private administration. And I don't have the screenshot with me, but the website was down. And I thought that was kind of apropos to the conversation around how third parties can kind of do it better. And then we went on at that moment, and the website did not work at that moment. So, again, I mean, I just want to make sure we're thinking about how this could impact the program, and it could hurt many of Minnesotans. And not to mention the fact these are jobs now that are going to be outsourced to some private entity, probably not in the state of Minnesota. And I always want to look to make sure we're protecting Minnesota workers and our economy here.
So to that, Mr. Representative Frazier, again, different states, different comparisons. I was not looking at the same state I was looking at last year because I knew the private option for a private run program was probably not going to work this year. So this was a different state I was looking at. I don't know what that state is doing any longer. Back then it was New Hampshire. So I wasn't looking at that at all. So this is a state-mandated program, but it's a large partnership that they have with a private company that is successfully deploying the services that they need, our families need. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you mentioned that you were looking at the states, and that makes me think of another point, and I was doing some research last night. For the states that did have early on when they started their programs and they did have those kind of private administrative programs, they saw that the cost to run the program went up like 2 to 3 times, and many of them then shifted back to not having private administrators. So, again, I'm trying to protect our interests here in Minnesota, and I want to make sure we've got these things top of mind as we're working through this for the rest of the session. So thank you for that. And then I've got a couple of more. One of the things that your bill does, it reduces the wage replacement rate to a flat 67%. And I guess the question is, that's going to impact a lot of the low-income workers. And I'm guessing, what is the purpose of that proposed change?
Representative Frazier, honestly, it was to try to just create a simpler, more easy version to understand. That is not an area that I'm going to, put a real stick in the ground on. It's an area that I thought for conversation-wise, I thought it was reasonable, it was fair. If we get pay that is towards the top of that scale of 100%, I know that it goes up to 90, I believe. Mm. Yeah, I think there's been some concerns that it's going to be a little harder to get some folks back to work on a regular basis or a timely basis, kind of like unemployment insurance. Again, it isn't meant to pay everything, but it's meant to make sure that we sustain our families with basic necessities. This is 2/3 pay. Thought it was very reasonable. Some other states do this. I got this from other states as well. So, again, it's part of the mix of the cafeteria style we can look at it, of what you like, what you hate, what you can live with, what can we talk about. Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I thank you for that answer. That's provided some clarity for the purpose behind it. But again, it goes back to who would be the most vulnerable in situations like that. And this kind of goes back to, again, to my earlier comments around the seasonal workers, right? These are folks that are low-wage workers, high-risk jobs. They would more likely need this program and need to ensure that they're closer to the wages. They have a closer percentage to the wages that they would need to avoid financial ruin when they would qualify for this program, which is, again, something kind of catastrophic where you've got to take off multiple weeks to take care of yourself. And so I just really want to make sure that we continue to focus and center the folks that are going to need this the most for this program to work for those individuals and to work for all Minnesotans. But glad you're open to more conversation as we continue to move forward.
And Representative Frazier, just again, I think you've got another question too. But again, to that, I'm also trying to find simplicity for the businesses that have to explain this. Most employees are not going to go to a website and say, how does this program work? They're going to go to their employers, their HR departments. Will you tell me, in my situation, Dave, where are you? How does this program work? And I guess, if you make this much, you get this percentage. If you make this much, you get this percentage, because I have different levels of that in my business too. So again, I think it was just simplicity about the folks that have to actually be a major part of rolling this thing out in a positive way to better explain it in a more simple manner. So, Representative Frazier, next question.
Thank you. Just to that, I mean, I absolutely can appreciate simplicity. You know, when I'm working with clients, I try to be as plain spoken as possible so they understand convoluted legal concepts. So that makes sense to me. But what I don't do is do it in a way that could potentially be harmful to the way that I'm advocating for them or working on the case that they have. And my concern is that simplicity could be harmful to the low-income workers that then are not going to be able to get up to the level of wage replacement that they would need to actually be sustainable, which is what this program is designed to do, and that is the intent. But I can appreciate trying to get to the simplicity. And one more point I would make is that the department, the deed will have what's called navigators in the program that would be able to individuals to call in, and they would explain the very things that you mentioned. So all of that burden would not be on the employer to have to navigate that. And those employers would also have access to those navigators as well to be able to make sure they're describing it accurately to the employers. And the most plain-spoken way is the folks can understand that. So I'm not too concerned about that kind of complicity getting in the way of the program being administered. So just in the lastly, I wanted to focus on, now your bill will cut down the number of weeks that people have access to, and you talked about this in your opening. And I guess the real question is, how did you come up with that concept that 50 employers or less, you'd have 6 weeks, and then 50 employers more, you would be up to 12 weeks? Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Representative Frazier, again, I was using the model for really the FMLA nationally recognized 50 employees and over is considered a large employer with the federal government. And vice versa, under 50 is a smaller business. There's different ideas with different states. Some of them are recognizing under 30 employees, some under 20. Some are completely excluded. This still doesn't actually ask that. But I also know, running a small business myself, having what I consider a very reasonable PTO program currently is nowhere near the 6 weeks off for paid family or paid medical. That would be something brand new on top of what I'm offering. So offering right now, many employees are getting nothing. So I don't think I'm cutting anything before they get something. You came out with an idea that the DFL did last year that this, you know, put out a very robust 12 up to 20. It sounds great on paper. It really does. And families, I get, want to have the most that they can. But I'm trying to be reasonable and respectful to the real world economics of small businesses and the ability for them to allow people to do those important life events and having 6 weeks off without going into your PTO time and maybe some ESST time if that's part of this. But still, 6 weeks, I think, in most cases is still a very solid program, very good benefits. And again, I think it's not cutting anything that's not out there yet. It's actually adding 6 weeks on, which I think is a very good, reasonable program, if we care about what the cost of the program is too. So I think it's a good balance. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. I think you mentioned that it's very good on paper. It's also very good in practice for those folks that have access to this in other states. I think you'd get some very positive feedback from those individuals in those states. And what I'll say is the concern I have about, you know, limiting this to 6 weeks, one, for small employers, is that I think it puts them at a disadvantage. And I know that's gonna bear out. If I'm someone looking for a job, and I know there's a LEAD program out there like this, I'm going to go for the employer that can give me the most benefits. And the employer that is in the state program that allows for 12 weeks, I'm going to absolutely go for that. I'm going to take my talents there versus to the smaller employer. I may love the smaller employer, but this is the business part of it, is that I have to do what's best for myself and for my family in case those kind of catastrophic issues, life issues, come up. And then the other concern I have is when I think about those that are trying to expand their families, one, having a baby isn't easy. You know, I've had three daughters. You know, one of them was my last child was very complicated. 2.5 months premature, 2.5 months in the hospital. After that, we had to spend a lot of time with our child. And my wife, she couldn't take the time off that she needed to, one, heal from that complicated pregnancy, and then, two, the time that was needed to be in the hospital on those days to actually bond with our child. So I remember what that situation was like. This program would have been very helpful in a situation for my family. And I know there's many families that will be in a situation like that. And I want to make sure that we are thinking of keeping those, again, front of mind when we're talking about cutting benefits that currently right now already exist. I mean, I know we keep saying folks haven't got it yet, but there is a very, very real anticipation because the law has been passed and it's on the books and ready to go for January 1st, 2026. So, again, just want to keep these things top of mind. And then last question.
Yeah, Representative, because I'm going to have 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we get to the couple other ones, too.
Right.
So go ahead.
You know what?
If you don't mind, I'd like to do that. But I also want to go back to one thing. One of the things that I'm thinking about for the small business idea that I had with the 6 weeks is we should allow those to go upwards if they want to go to a different tier. If they want to choose to move up, again, I haven't had the deep conversation with the department, but that might be an option that they want to do because of competitive reasons, Representative Frazier. So again, I'm not saying they have to stick there or stay there. They can maybe roll up if they choose to do that for the benefit set that they need. But again, I'm hearing more and more and more all the time from small businesses, we think 6 weeks would be a very, very good, robust program. So to that, thank you for your questions. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to yield my time to Rep. Frazier if he has more questions.
Sure. Thank you. And then also I have, let me go to Wayne Johnson. Representative Wayne Johnson, for you were on the list. And then I'll go back to Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to, as I listen to the comments and the continued belief that, you know, today we're talking about paid family and medical leave, and we need to be honest about something. Small businesses are not the same as large corporations. Yet we keep treating them like they are. One employee is not the same as another. And not everyone looks for the same thing in a job. Benefits don't always define a company. And we need to stop assuming that we do, that the only reason somebody ever would work with a company is because they have awesome benefits. People choose to work for small businesses for many reasons. Some want to be treated as a person, not just a position. Others, like I did, want to learn how to run a business, how to create jobs, futures, and opportunities for others. Some need flexibility. Some are asking for an opportunity to prove themselves. And the costlier you make that, the less likely that business will take a chance. Others just need work for a short period of time. Let's remember that when we talk about why people choose where they work, one size fits all mandates don't work for everyone, and I'm afraid of unintended consequences. Companies not willing to take chances at people that are looking to start their career right out of college or try to change something new. I look forward to finding a solution for all employers and current employees and future hopeful employees. And one thing I'd just like to add at the end is I find it interesting when we, in this committee, it seems like the belief is that big business is the best way for people to go. If I go upstairs, one committee away, that committee is about big business is bad, and we need to investigate the heck out of all of them and treat them like they're trying to mess with people. It's just interesting how two different floors can have that, two different opinions. And if you want to know which committee it is, it's tax. It was just yesterday. You can go online and see that. So it's just wanted to put that in there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wayne Johnson. I didn't hear a question, so I think what I'm going to do is go back to Representative Frazier. And I wanted to make one statement before I let you on your final thoughts. Back to the negotiating with unions and that choice. I think that, again, I want to make sure, and this is to any union folks that are listening, if they have some better wordsmithing for this, it should be their choice if they want to be in or out. But what it does is it sets up the table for a conversation then if they want to be included in the paid family medical leave program. It obviously then affects the rest of the negotiations because it is a very new and real added benefit to their set. If you are suggesting any new wording to how I have that worded, if you think it didn't really have the clarity that I was trying to explain, again, I'm very happy to sit down and look at what kind of language would be better for you. So, Representative Frazier, your final thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that that offer. We will have those conversations. I just want to respond to some comments that were just made. So, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. The current bill, as it is stated, there are premium breaks for small businesses. There are small business grants to help those small businesses to carry out this program when they lose someone for training and purposes of that nature. And I will have to note, in your bill, it changes that premium rate break, and it requires small businesses to pay 50-50. So it actually is an increase on small businesses in your bill. So I want to get away from this narrative that this is a one-size-fits-all. Many of the parameters in the current law that's in place now was put in place because of conversations with the corporations and with small businesses to ensure that we address the needs that they raise. So I just want to, I want to get away from mythical narratives and get to the reality of what the law currently stands. And then I got one last question, and then I'll do some closing comments. But my one last question was around you changed the definition for who's considered family. I'm really trying to zero in on why was that a necessary change in your bill.
Representative Frazier, again, I don't have that exact wording right in front of me here, but it's about the
chosen
non-family, it's the expected caregiver language. It's sort of like this is an expected caregiver. When I read that language, I have not seen that clarity or that what I would call it squishy language in other states' language. Usually, again, it's more family definitions, again, through the FMLA or some other areas. Again, it's important to include domestic partners and stepfathers and mothers and things like that. But again, that last line of, and anyone that's expected to be a caregiver of some sorts, again, they asked the department, and I see that to be a problem down the road. I could see where that could be abused, frankly, and I want to clean up the language. And that was the intent of that, Representative Frazier.
So there's going to be processes for verification of these relationships. So I'm not super concerned about the abuse in that sense. And I also don't like to, you know, just be presumptive that someone will try to abuse it. But I do think about situations where it could be that change could be most impactful. When I think about it, it's in situations where you've got someone that maybe they're a new immigrant to the country. They don't have family here, but they've connected with a family that maybe they're living with, if an exchange student or things like that. And those folks would be responsible as caregivers if a situation was to arise. I'm thinking about people that live in more rural areas where they may be the last line of their family. They don't have any family left, or they're not close enough. They may depend on the community to have to take care of them. I don't want to exclude people in situations like that because I think that would be harmful. And these are our neighbors and our community members in Minnesota. Again, thoughts I want to make sure we keep top of mind when we're thinking about making those changes. And just so I'll close with this is that, you know, the proposed changes are significantly going to impact millions of people, you know, in the state of Minnesota. And that was not the intent of this bill. The intent was to create a floor so that folks, when they needed to, when they qualified, when they meet the thresholds for paid family medical leave, they would be able to take the time off for themselves and for their loved ones in doing that without the consequences or the fear of financial ruin. And I just want to make sure we stick to the intent of that as we move forward on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Again, members, thank you for the conversation this morning. Again, my door is always open. I'm willing to work on some language tweaks, but I am very serious that we need to have conversations about this if we really want to launch a positive program in 2026 or 2027, whatever we get through with this. So thank you, members, very much. I'm going to move on to the next item. So I'm going to close discussion on House File 1976. Thank you. I am going to change the agenda just a tiny bit. I see Representative Kosnick has joined us. And his bill, I'm going to bring Representative Kosnick up here first for House File 0510. Representative Kosnick, welcome to the greatest committee ever, the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development. I know you served, I think, on Economic Development in the last couple of years, so it's good to have you back. Get you settled in, Representative Chair Kosnick, and please proceed. I should say that the chair will move House File 510 to be considered for being laid over to a further bill. Thank you, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate being back in this committee as the former lead of economic development. I'm honored to have House File 510 with me that appropriates $4 million to help Enterprise Minnesota support Minnesota's small manufacturing companies and their employees. I know the committee's short on time. I'm just going to leave it there and have my testifiers speak. I know there's a bill brief in there, and we can take some questions if needed. So I'll just turn it over to Mr. Kill.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Kill. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Kill, and I'm the president and CEO of Enterprise Minnesota. Enterprise Minnesota is a created in state statute 501c3 nonprofit consulting organization that is one of 50 federal manufacturing extension partnerships from across the country, and there's one in each state. We're here to ask you today to support House File 510, which does invest $4 million in job creating, job-retaining services for small manufacturers throughout the state. Manufacturing employs some of the best high-wage jobs in our state, and the industry is the backbone of the economy and lifeblood of many communities statewide. Within House File 510, we propose investments in two appropriations, $2 million for the Made in Minnesota program that will help manufacturers stay in our state, but to prepare them to apply technology and automation into their operations to compete in the future. $2 million to enable Enterprise Minnesota to reach and deliver our services across the state. These resources are targeted to companies with 250 or fewer employees in every corner of the state. That title says there's 80% of the Minnesota manufacturers are below that number. Some important statistics to understand about the industry. There are 8,625 manufacturers in Minnesota. 49% are in the seven-county Twin City area, and 51% are in greater Minnesota. Manufacturing provides 11% of our jobs and 14% of wages, an impressive multiplier. There are 325,000 manufacturing jobs, providing about 1 million direct and indirect jobs overall. And the average wage is $1,387. I heard the other day that a starting wage for a young man or young woman coming out of one of our technical colleges in welding is about $40 per hour. Enterprise Minnesota provides the help they need to stay in their business, stay in their community, and keep the employees and grow. The past year alone, we have assisted over 130 Minnesota small manufacturing companies. These bills will allow us to touch more companies across the state. As Representative Kosnick said, the appropriation to Enterprise Minnesota has been in state statute since 2008 under the name GAP. It has achieved widespread bipartisan support because it does truly help manufacturers create high-quality jobs to their local communities. On the average, these funds have proven a return on the state's investment by at least $25 for every dollar investment, and that's true in the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota. And especially in greater Minnesota, private business improvement services are really scarce, and we are really one of the only sources to reach across the state. This investment will not only help our smallest manufacturers, but it will unlock federal matching dollars. For every dollar the state invests in House File 510, Enterprise Minnesota can leverage another federal dollar from this manufacturing extension partnership. Obviously, without this investment, the federal match dollars are lost and fewer manufacturers will be served and many left to fend for themselves. Overall, the history has been very impressive. An independent survey on a national level showed that our clients have collectively created or retained over 12,000 jobs in Minnesota. They have boosted and retained company sales by $1.46 billion. And saved $206 million in business costs that would have been unnecessary expenses. These companies also have invested almost $600 million in their plant, equipment, and technology to stay competitive in the world we live in. Both bills also have reporting requirements, so you will see the impacts and results of these. Maintaining manufacturing strength is essential to our state's future. And on behalf of the small manufacturers, I hope you will support these impact investments. Thank you for the opportunity. And I turn the microphone now to Matt Hansen, one of the manufacturers that appreciates what this program can do.
Thank you, Mr. Keel, very much for your testimony. I also just, we do have a lot of bills today, and I failed to mention that we're looking for maybe 2-3 minutes for each testifier. So appreciate that. From beautiful Candiway County, I'd like to welcome Mr. Matt Hansen. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the community, the committee. My name is Matt Hansen, and I am the president of Hansen Companies, formerly Hansen Silo. We're a 109-year-old family business, and we're located on a 40-acre property that was my great-grandpa's home farm near Lake Lillian, Minnesota. So my brother and I actually are the fourth generation of owners at our place, and our main business is precast concrete, farm equipment, and we've expanded tremendously throughout the years into contract manufacturing, including powder coating, laser cutting, bending, and we provide those services for a variety of industries. We employ about 85 people and have sales of about $19 million annually. We are constantly looking to add employees and have budgeted roughly about $850,000 in equipment expansions every year. And for example, last year we actually bought a saw, a new boom truck, and a bunch of other items that we need to continue to grow our company. We serve all kinds of clients like Cargill, ADM, big co-ops, small co-ops. We serve commercial agricultural folks and family farms. So like other Minnesota manufacturers, we rely on many resources to continually improve, grow, and retain our employees. In fact, we actually have multiple third-generation employees at our place. And I'm here to express my strong support for House File 510. I support this legislation because it will provide manufacturers, companies like ours, with the ability to improve business and keep and grow their valued employees. Companies like ours throughout the state are the economic engines that drive our state's manufacturing sector. During the COVID economy, in spite of the uncertainty, virtually all manufacturers were recognized and called on as essential businesses that kept operating, supporting our employees, clients, and our communities. The economic impact of our business is significant to Minnesota by way of taxes, employee spending in the area, as well as money that we spend with local suppliers. We are also active in the charities around the area. And the main thing that has done this is the gap funding that we've been able to use. We've used gap funding many times.
Mr. Hanson, we need to wrap it up.
Okay.
Thank you.
The gap funding that we've used is imperative for us to grow and sustain what we're currently doing, add employees, and continue into the next 100 years.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And again, is there any other testifiers that want to speak in favor of or opposition to this bill? Seeing none, I'll take it to member questions. Any questions for members? Again, this bill will be held over for further consideration. Seeing none, final comments, Representative Chair Kosnick.
Well, again, Mr. Chair and committee, I appreciate the time today. I know it's a busy part of the session, but I encourage you, in almost every community that we all represent, there's an industrial park or a manufacturing center. And sometimes we just cruise by them and go about to where we're headed, the grocery store, or school, or work, or wherever. But take the time to stop in there and see what's actually being done in those manufacturing centers, those industrial parks, and you'll be amazed at the amount of jobs that are created there. And this bill helps small businesses in your district to help grow and continue to make our economy thrive. So I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you very much, Representative Kosnick. Again, the chair will re-refer this House File 510 for further consideration. We're laying it over. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. Next bill, members up, is House File 2238. Representative Bakeberg, if you would come forward. Welcome to your committee. Please go ahead and move your bill, if you would, and proceed.
I move the bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the privilege to represent the communities of Prior Lake, Jordan, Shakopee, and the surrounding townships. House File 2238 requires the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to approve youth skills training in the construction trades at a central location, such as headquarters or training facilities. The goal of the bill is simple. allow youth skills districts to partner with construction companies to have 16 and 17-year-old students work at the office site. It's important to note that. It is that these students would be at an office building, not a job site, and not working with dangerous tools. This bill would allow students to gain valuable opportunities and exposure to the construction trades industry, such as project management, drafting, sales, marketing, and interior design. I'm a little bit passionate about that side of it because my daughter is studying that currently. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a number of testifiers, so for the sake of time, I would just move to testimony.
Thank you, Representative Akeberg. If the testifiers could please come forward. Again, I've got Kate is up first. If we'd come forward, also on deck is Mr. Zunker. If you would also come up to the table. Again, we have a two-minute time limit today because of the number of testifiers today, so that would be appreciated. So, Kate, I don't want to mispronounce your last name, so if you want to introduce yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 2238. My name is Kate Peruschek, and I am Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. First, I would like to thank Representative Bakeberg for meeting with me yesterday to discuss his goals for this legislation. I appreciated the opportunity to share that DLI similarly appreciates that many high school students in Minnesota have access to career and technical education, work-based learning, and employment-based training to explore their interests and career possibilities that could follow graduation. Several school districts throughout the state offer opportunities for high school students to learn about the building and construction trades, often through hands-on experiential learning in a controlled environment, with adequate instruction, safety and health training, appropriate personal protective equipment, and supervision by qualified instructors. These types of training programs are a safe and appropriate way for high school students to gain exposure to construction as a possible career. The Youth Skills Training Program, or YST, however, is not the appropriate program for the construction industry, and we are opposed to the bill. To provide some background to the committee, YST supports the development of partnerships between schools, employers, local businesses, and community-based organizations that implement and coordinate YST programs for student learners who are 16 and 17 years of age. Programs provide career exposure, industry-related classroom instruction, high school and post-secondary credits, safety training, industry-recognized credentials, and safe, meaningful, paid work experience in high-growth, high-demand living wage careers. The commissioner has approved YST programs in five key industries: advanced manufacturing, agriculture, automotive, healthcare, and information technologies. These industries include occupations that are in demand and high growth and were determined by analyzing labor market information and wage data and through significant stakeholder engagement. DLI also considered current state and federal child labor laws restrictions, as well as limitations that could be put in place to ensure the health and safety of 16 and 17-year-old student learners in otherwise hazardous work environments. Given that the YST statute requires that the work of the student learner in occupations declared particularly hazardous shall be incidental to the training. Under the guidance of Minnesota OSHA and the Labor Standards Division at DLI, YST has been able to ease some child labor law restrictions in the five approved industry areas through the rigorous YST employer approval process. But those instances are heavily vetted and equipment specific. I'll just wrap up.
Thank you, Ms. Pershick,
As Representative Bakeberg described, my understanding of the intent of the bill is to add a specific occupation to YST. A minor would not be prohibited from that type of work and would not require a child labor exemption to work in an office setting for a construction company. As an alternative to the legislation, DLI recommends that the author consider an MDE-approved work-based learning program for this specific initiative.
Thank you, Ms. Peruschek. I need to move on, so thank you so much. Appreciate that. Mr. Zunker, you are up, please, and then Joel Hansen, if you could please come to the table and prepare. Mr. Zunker, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tim Zunker, and I'm the president of the Shakopee Chamber and Visitors Bureau. Workforce development is a primary focus for our chamber. We serve as the convening organization for the Academies of Shakopee program at Shakopee High School, which provides students with career-focused education across six specialized academies. Also, through a grant we received, our chamber currently provides wage reimbursement to businesses participating in U-Skills training programs in healthcare and manufacturing. We hope to extend the support to construction trades, but current restrictions limit these opportunities. House File 2238 would allow us to work with local businesses to create career pathway opportunities for students in construction trades by enabling training at central locations like headquarters sites or training facilities. This approach provides students with valuable experience in a safe, controlled environment. The legislation is critical when we look at Scott County's demographic projections, which show concerning trends from 2022 to 2035, including a 4.5% decrease in our 5 to 14-year-old population, a 5.8% decrease in our 15 to 24-year-old population. These projections signal workforce shortages unless we engage youth in sustainable career paths like construction, which offers an average annual wage of almost $86,000 in Scott County, significantly higher than the county's overall average wage of a little over $59,400. In addition, the construction industry is projected to grow 6.5% in the Twin Cities region by 2032, creating over 5,000 new jobs, but struggles to attract enough workers. The Shakopee Chamber is committed to creating career pathways for students and those most in need in our county. House File 2238 will help create opportunities in thriving, sustainable careers by removing unnecessary barriers while maintaining safety measures. We strongly urge your support of this common sense approach to workforce development that will benefit students, businesses, and our entire community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zucker, very much. Excuse me. Welcome, Mr. Hansen, and if Brian Cruiser could head up to the table, that'd be great. Thank you, and welcome.
Chair Baker, members of the committee, my name is Joel Hansen, Director of Government Affairs as Associated Builders and Contractors. I'll be brief in my comments. ABC supports this legislation for the only reason that we need more folks in the construction industry. Nationally, it's estimated that we're going to be short 439,000 folks in the construction industry this year. And so to talk a little bit more about that, one of our local members, Greystone Construction, located in Shakopee, Minnesota.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Cruiser, welcome. And again, if Mr. Larson could come forward, that'd be great.
Chair Baker and members of the committee, my name is Brian Kreiser. I'm the vice president of Greystone Construction, and we're headquartered in Shakopee. I'm pleased to offer testimony today for Representative Bakeberg's bipartisan bill. I'm here today because I'm a product of a program that was similar to this. 25 years ago, as a 16-year-old, Shakopee High School had an apprenticeship program where I was able to go and work in the field, which is different than this, but it's similar, right? So from there, you know, with some guidance of a teacher, I started with Greystone at the age of 16, graduated with honors, was able to continue working with Greystone, had a four-year apprenticeship program with the company that we went through, and really offered up a great learning experience to continue to guide my path in my career. At 20 years old, I was able to buy my own house. So it was a great opportunity for me to get in, learn a trade, and accelerate my career. The valuable hands-on learning experience I received through the high school apprenticeship program not only confirmed my career path in construction, but started me in the business that I now co-own. Had it not been for that work, I wouldn't be here. So this is why I support the expansion of the youth skills training program in the construction trades. We need many pathways to expose students to careers in the construction industry. Expanding the youth skills program would allow that to happen while simultaneously allowing students to earn their educational credit and, more importantly, be compensated for their work while they're there. At Greystone, we currently have two high school students participating in an unpaid internship program. It's been working well, and it does get them a little bit of exposure, but it'd be nice to be a little more in depth with this and compensate them for their time. And their focus is more on the construction management side of the skills.
Thank you, Mr. Cruiser. We actually have to kind of wrap it up, but thank you so much. Appreciate your testimony today. Sean Larson, you're up.
Yes,
welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee, for your time today. I'm the president of All Star Construction here in Minneapolis. We employ 150 employees and run about 1,200 subcontractors every day. I'd like to begin by sharing that I've been in the construction industry for 28 years, specializing in exterior trades, roofing, siding, windows, gutters. I started roofing at the age of 16, working summers throughout high school and beyond. Back then, there was no formal training. There was no safety plan. There was no insurance. We were winging it. College was not an option for me. I struggled academically throughout my entire schooling career. I knew that if I pursued a trade, I would have control and be held accountable for my own success or lack thereof. I support this bill because I believe there's many others out there just like me who struggle in a traditional classroom but may thrive in a hands-on working environment. The construction industry has come a long way in terms of professionalism, integrating technology, expanding opportunities. We are in urgent need of skilled technicians, estimators, project managers. However, fewer and fewer people continue to jump into our industry. It leaves a significant gap in the workforce in the construction trades. This bill would give young people a head start in their careers while providing them a safe and structured learning environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson, very much. To the members of the audience, anyone have any other thoughts, concerns, or support for the bill? Seeing no other, we'll close. Oh, sorry. Oh, go ahead. Yep, 2 minutes, please, if you want to go to the testimony. Thank you. Please introduce yourself, and 2 minutes, please. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for the time. My name is Spencer Grant. Good morning. I'm the founding director of Uncommon Construction Minneapolis. Many of you probably have not heard of me. We're new to Minneapolis. But I was part of the founding team of this nonprofit construction company in New Orleans, Louisiana, 10 years ago. Uncommon Construction is a workforce development nonprofit that empowers youth with the skills, network, experience, and resources to lead the workforce after they graduate from high school. We do that through our unique work-based learning experience in which students from different schools apply to our nonprofit company to join a team of interns to earn above minimum wage hourly pay and school credit for building a house or another project together. With the revenue generated from those projects, we match our youth earnings with an equity award scholarship for them to use for further education or career opportunities after they graduate from high school. I know time is short, so I will keep it very brief. As part of the founding of the program in Louisiana, I was very proud to be able to bring it here and be the founding director of the first expansion site of this programming in my hometown of Minneapolis. When we started here, Department of Labor and Industry granted our youth individual exemptions. The form is LI-817-2C, which is an individualized work exemption used for 16 and 17-year-olds for a work opportunity that is deemed in the best interest of the youth. As we got that exemption and worked with them, we tried to establish our flagship programming, which is to build a residential home over the course of a school year and sell that out to the community. Knowing that this individualized exemption was a cumbersome pathway for Uncommon's programming, we were told that an agency-wide exemption for a program like Uncommon would be forthcoming. Unexpectedly, we were unable to continue receiving that individualized exemption, which kept us from growing our expansion. A pathway in something like the U-Skills training program for construction would greatly increase our impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grant, very much for your testimony. I will then close testimony. Members, any questions on the bill? Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Baker, thanks for I appreciate what you're doing here, attempting to do here in bringing young people in to construction. In addition to the opposition from DLI, I understand from the building trades that they're opposed as well. I'm hoping to testify, just wasn't able to be here this morning. Based on the language of the bill, I'll say that it's a short bill, but as a child welfare advocate, I get
kind of freaked out by the phrase in 1.11, 1.12 about exempting the young people from, quote, any conflicting child labor laws. I'd be more comfortable if you sort of identified the specific child labor laws, as that's pretty broad and kind of freaks me out. I will say that what I've heard from the building trades echoing what DLI said is they really appreciated conversations with you. It sounds like conversations are ongoing about language. There may be a way to get there. So the bill as written right now, I guess I'd have significant concerns about echoing those expressed by the other groups, but hopefully perhaps there is a path there. So I guess I'd urge you to continue those conversations with them. And thank you to you, and thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bakeberg?
Yeah, I'm always willing to have ongoing conversations to improve bills and even address bills that are passed that we need to improve. So always willing to do that. And actually, the trades emailed me this morning with their suggestions, and I would welcome suggestions from Dolly as well. So happy to do that.
Thank you. Any other member questions? I see none. Thank you very much. Close up your bill, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I just want to thank my co-authors, Representative Mueller, Representative Tabke, and I want to thank our testifiers. Many are from my district, from the area that Representative Tabke and I represent in Shakopee. So just thank you to our testifiers. Again, from my perspective, this bill is pretty straightforward and simple. This would allow Youth Skills School Districts to partner with construction companies to get 16 and 17-year-old students to work in the office. The bill is needed because of Dolly's strict interpretation of what a construction site is. And Mr. Peruschek did a nice job of laying out what the five DLI-approved areas are for youth skills. So, I just want to paint a picture for you. So it's advanced manufacturing. So an example of that is our welders, manufacturers, machinists, tool and die makers, agriculture, automotive, healthcare, and information technology. So this morning on my way in, I was having a conversation with a business owner, and he shares a bill. He owns the building, but shares it with three other companies. Is his construction company, another construction company, a welding manufacturer, and then an auto mechanic shop. And this is the question I asked Dolly yesterday and didn't get a straight answer. And this is the question that this business owner asked me today. He said, Ben, help me understand. So a kid could work in the auto mechanic shop doing drafting, doing sales, doing marketing, could work in the machinist shop, in the welding and manufacturing, and doing sales, doing marketing, doing drafting, but they couldn't do that in my office, and we're under the same roof. That's the type of common sense solution that we're trying to bring to this, just to office sites. So this is common sense. If we applied this same measure that we just don't want to do this, that Dolly has said, that rigid interpretation of a construction site, our high school PAGE program wouldn't fit that definition. So this is common sense. I look forward to working together. I am always willing to work with any stakeholder, and I look forward to doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. House File 2238 will be laid over for further consideration. Thank you. Next up, House File 108, Representative Hussein, if you'd please come forward. And again, Representative Hussein, I see we've got three testifiers. We'll keep everybody to that two-minute mark if we can. Yeah. Appreciate your brevity today. Again, House File 108, to your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Breaker and Co-Chair Pinto, and a member of the House Workforce Committee, for considering this important workforce appropriation request for Ojama Place. Ojama Place was founded in 2009 when St. Paul African American leadership, responding to the significant gap for young black men living in the lowest and a social economic spectrum, by working collectively with other nonprofit and the community partnership. Ojama Place serves primary African American men age 18 to 30 from the Twin Cities, seven counties metro area, who enroll with no cost. The theory of this transformation is to provide them with dozens of transformation support services to build, positive life for themselves and to move into contribution role in society. This bill would help further a mission for appropriation for the $2.5 million for 2026 and 2027. I have three testifiers with me today at JAMA Place, and two of them are enrolled already, and they will tell us their stories. And I also have Michael Bolt, the interim CEO of JAMA, who is doing a wonderful job. I would like to, so we can save some time.
Welcome, Mr. Belton. Again, welcome to the committee. We've got 2 minutes, so please proceed and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, co-chair Baker and co-chair Pinto, as well as the greatest committee ever. Thank you.
Okay, 2 minutes and 15 seconds now.
My name is Michael Belton, and I have the honor to serve as the interim CEO of Ujamaa Place one more time. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in strong support of House File 108. I'd like to thank our author, Representative Hussein, and for carrying this bill and for his important support of Ujamaa Place. As Representative Hussein described, Ujamaa Place has been an important part of the Twin Cities community for almost two decades. Our programs offer housing, education, job training, mental health support, and mentorship, and helping participants, whom we call Ujamaa men, build self-sufficiency and break cycles of poverty and incarceration. In short, investing in Ujamaa Place is an investment in young men who wish to change their lives and contribute to their communities. I ask your support of House File 108 and ensure that we can continue empowering young men to achieve stability, dignity, and success. I'm also privileged to have with me two Ujamaa men, Joshua and Titus, who are far more eloquent than I am, who can share their experiences with the with our organization. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Belton, very much for your testimony. I've got Titus up next. If you'd introduce yourself and carry on with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Titus Forsyth. I'm from northern Minnesota, Bemidji area. I was adopted when I was 5 years old from Liberia, and I've been living here ever since. And Ujamaa has changed my life in so many different ways. It's taught me stability. It's taught me mentorism and what that means to me and how they can teach me how to be a leader in my community and how to change my community by being a leader myself. And through that, the word Ujamaa means to be your brother's keeper. And just in being that, you can change many things. And thank you for having me today.
Thank you very much. Great testimony. And Joshua, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Joshua Thomas. I'm a Ujamaa brother. Ujamaa to me is a peaceful garden for people who look like myself. I really haven't been, what's the word? I'm sorry. I'm kind of nervous.
That's all right.
Okay, take your time. You know,
it's okay.
I didn't have nowhere to go. You know, me, my mom getting kicked out the house, you know. It was my first time being independent, and I didn't know what to do or how to be independent. With Ujamaa, they helped me with housing. They helped me physically in the gym, mentally, you know, just meditating. For me, I just hope that I can be a leader to, you know, people like I, and, you know, tell them about Ujamaa, because, you know, this is a place where I think that two people, and thank you for having me.
You still actually had about a minute left. That's what the card said, 1 minute left. So go ahead, Kinteri.
Can I speak on that more, since we have a minute left?
Sure, you got a minute left. You bet. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Would you introduce yourself? Just for the record, just say who you are again.
My name is Titus Forsyth again.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So what Josh is saying is very true. Through those programs, we have a brother where we have a group of guys to come together, where we have a community, where we can build on that community, and also it teaches us how to work together and how to strive for our goals.
And so, make ripples and help people such as ourselves.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very, very much, guys. And you did a great job with your testimony today. So any other testifiers? I don't see anybody else on the list, Representative Hussein. Seeing none, and then we'll go to member questions. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers especially. Grateful that you're here today. Can you kind of share for us, as young men in the community around St. Paul or all of the Twin Cities, if that's what Ujamaa Place really serves, what is the mechanism that has given you and I to even come to Ujamaa Place? What are the mechanisms that you found that brought you to Ujamaa Place? Can you kind of describe how you got there and like what Ujamaa Place does to encourage young men to find this outlet?
Mr. Forcine, did you want to answer that?
I can go first. Okay. My name is Titus Forcine again. And how does that play into everything is that it definitely helps us to come every day and just for us to find that sense of community, sense of family, sense of love, because most of us don't have that in our families when we go home from there. And it's very easy to, like, get lost in not having those type of things and just being out and on your own without having those basic needs that we have at Ujamaa and what they represent there. So it's very nice to have that as men.
Mr. Thomas, did you want to comment?
Yeah, they help us with, you know, financial literacy, you know, how to hold our money accountable. They definitely teach us about how to create a business, how to make business. And
they put us through these programs where we have the training to do those businesses and have the one-on-one time with the people teaching us those businesses so we don't have failures like every day that we have in our normal lives and struggles that we do.
Representative Schultz, I would like to add it.
Representative Hussein.
I have been in Ujamaa for multiple times, and I would like you to go visit. These kids feel safe, and they feel home, and they feel belonging in the area that they show up every day. Not only that, they help with financially, but also mentally, physically, and discussions, and empowering them, and also mentorship, because a lot of black us, growing up, we did not have a mentorship, so this is a place for them to guide them and to kind of push them where they wanted to be at. I wanted to share a few stories that why is this program is very successful, because I seen many young kids that graduated. Some of them are working with our county commissioner, Rena Moran. Some of them are working with legislative assistants. Some of them become a lawyer, some of them become doctors. So those are the goals that we're trying to push for those young kids to make sure that they're very successful in the society that we're in.
Thank you. And one final member question from Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Representative, for this bill, and thank you to the testifiers. It was very informative. And my question is, this committee, we see a lot of really great programs, and our role is to look for opportunities that are going to best serve this state for labor and workforce. And so my question is, I was looking at the theory of transformation, and I've seen different models like this over the last 30 years. But I'm curious from your perspective of, and for us as committee members, with all the opportunities that may or may not exist, why you believe this funding is transformational to a degree that may be different than other programs? What sets it apart? Yes, what sets this program apart?
Is that a question for Mr. Belton, or do you want to handle that, Representative Hussein?
Yes, my name is Titus.
Yes, go ahead.
Titus Borsine. Can you repeat the question one more time for me, please?
What would you say sets this program apart from other programs that are doing models, you know, to help people for transformation?
Okay, I can answer it now. So what sets us apart in this program is that we are building leaders of tomorrow to lead us into a world that we don't know what the future holds.
because most of us don't know what tomorrow is going to bring for us. And where we're at right now is the best place we can be. And they're teaching us how to be those people that we need to be to keep on pushing forward and pushing our own generation and the generation after us. And that's what we need in our community right now.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to follow up.
I got to wrap this up. So Mr. Belton came to the table. Do you have a quick statement? And then we need to move on to the next bill. Mr. Belton, go ahead.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Chair. What sets Ujamaa Place apart are probably a panoply of things that are visible and invisible. Some of the more visible things are that we wrap young men around our supports, around the supports and services. A lot of other programs focus on, like, manufacturing, focus on healthcare. We focus on all of it, and that's part of the reason, a big reason why we've come here, and for financial support, because we see the need every day for men to come to get the kind of services that we can provide. It's just a matter of equating the dollars with the number of men.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bell. Appreciate that. Final comments, Representative Hussein.
I just want to thank you all, but I just want to put this on the record. Black Minnesota face some of the worst unemployment and income gap in the state of Minnesota. Unemployment is near three times higher for black workers than the white workers. They are unrepresented in higher paid jobs and overrepresented in the low income sector. Educational barrier limit access to professional care, career like medicine and businesses. Systemic challenge, discrimination, lack of access to quality education and hiring base continue to restrict economic mobility for black Minnesotans. We need to do better and we need to invest this kind of work. We need a workforce investment, equitable education, and fair hiring policy that close the gap. Minnesota's economic is strong when everyone has a fair shot at successful. Thank you for having me here, and this is what we need to do is to help, and I hope we can have a support both parties so we can have our young generation succeed.
Thank you, Representative Hussein. The chair again will move House File 108 for consideration for a later bill. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming in today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is House File 1577. Representative Frazier, if you would come forward with Ms. Anderson, that'd be great. Representative Frazier will move House File 1577 in front of the committee. Representative Frazier, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This House File 1577 would create a statewide information campaign for Minnesota employers in second chance hiring. Deed conducted a survey that showed that many Minnesota employers that are looking for workers, and there's a dearth of workers out there, would hire folks that previously had have been justice impacted. But what they also showed in that survey was that they didn't know where to look for those employers. So what House File 1577 would do would require Deed to set up a website to help facilitate access to second chance individuals and allow the employers to have access to that so they can find those individuals for second chance hiring. Well, it does have support from the Justice Action Network and also the St. Paul Chamber, St. Paul Area Chamber, and I will let my testifier speak to as well.
Thank you very much. Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, and I'm here representing the Justice Action Network in support of House File 1577. The Justice Action Network is a bipartisan organization dedicated to improving the criminal justice system and public safety outcomes at the state and federal levels. The Justice Action Network has been active in Minnesota since 2016. As part of the organization's work over the past 8 years, the Justice Action Network has been engaged in several states and nationally with employers on issues related to second chance hiring. This bill is brought forward today as part of the organization's work with employers and is modeled after successful and bipartisan legislation that was introduced and passed in Wisconsin in 2024. This legislation will narrow the gap and provide employers with up-to-date information on state and federal benefits related to second chance hired. As Representative Frazier mentioned, Deed conducted a survey and found that while two-thirds of employers were willing to hire second chance individuals from second chance through second chance hiring, it found that about 85% of them didn't have the information of what they should be doing and the benefits of hiring those individuals. As part of your packet, you should have this background document. That document provides much greater information, and we really appreciate your support and consideration of House File 1577. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Any further testifiers in the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none. Member questions. Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Frazier for bringing
this. Rep. Johnson, you could pull that microphone for you a little bit. Oh. Thank you. Sorry. There you go.
Thank you for bringing this forward. This is a great opportunity or great program to help people that are in need, also get those out there working. But I also just want to bring up here, I know they had various different incentives from the federal government to take a chance or a second chance. And so I think it's a recognition also that when we are working with employers and trying to get people to get second chances, the federal government recognizes there needs to be incentives and make the transition, the opportunity easier, not harder, to get people out in the field. So I just want to make sure that, you know, this brings back how important it is when you want to give second chances to people. And I've actually hired a number of people that have had challenging backgrounds and said, come on board, and some have worked great and some still go back to the demons that they've had in the past. But we great opportunities. So we still need to make opportunities and make it easier for employers to take that chance and take that risk. So I just noticed in here that there's great programs that employers have to be able to take that chance. So thank you for bringing forward. I think it would be very, very useful for on both ends, win-win situations. So I much, very much support this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any further member questions? Co-Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, maybe I'll just say real quickly, I really appreciate this. Working outside the legislature as a prosecutor, I feel a particular responsibility, right, to make sure that folks who are coming out of incarceration or coming out of a felony conviction are in shape to contribute to our society. And I guess the two things jumped out at me, and I'll admit I just hadn't focused on this before, but I just want to make sure we're highlighting. So this statistic about just under 10% of working age adults in Minnesota have at least one felony conviction on the record. Mr. Chair, you've made many references to our workforce shortage. And boy, if we can get folks off the bench and in the workforce, that's a huge challenge. Almost 10% of working age adults. And then the other thing is, I guess when I first heard this, Representative Frazier, I kind of thought it was sort of generally talking to employers about sort of, you know, generally, hey, you should be doing this, a good thing. But this is really concrete that there are very specific programs that an employer would not be aware of. So the connecting, this is a lot more, I guess, concrete than I first realized when I looked at this, is making employers be aware of specifically what they can get access to. So a big benefit. So thank you for this, Representative Frazier. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. And again, I think this is a great program. I'm proud to be a co-chair on this bill for you too as well. Final member question, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My simple question is, for those who are in this population, what number of people who are seeking a second chance aren't currently employed today?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, I don't have that number off the top of mind, but I'll see if we can do some research and dig and get it for you. What I can say is, what we do know, there are still many barriers faced by folks that are in this situation. So if we can make sure we're helping employers know that they're out there and create more opportunities, I think that's going to be for the best.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up?
Well, yeah, just quickly. I mean, 1 out of 11, I agree that that's a high number. I'm just seeking to see, you know, of that number, what of that, you know, 1 out of 11, what percentage isn't employed today, and is that in line with our other unemployment trends statewide? That would be my overarching question that I'd like to get the answer to. Thank you.
Seeing no other member questions, final comments, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for mentioning that you were a co-author on this bill. I appreciate you being a co-author on this bill, and for other colleagues that are on the bill as well, and for my Democratic colleagues, thank you for joining me on this. I do think it's critically important. I always say that accountability has its place, but for us as a society, as a country, it's the then what that is most important, and I think we have not done a great job of doing that well. This is another tool to create a pathway back into the community for positive things, and I'm looking forward for support on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing House File 1577 forward to the committee. It will be considered for a further bill at a later time. Members, next up is House File 1960. Representative Mueller, if you'd take the stand. And if your testifiers could come forward, that would be terrific. Oh, they're on Zoom today. Okay. Representative Mueller, to your bill, 1960.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. First bill in front of the Labor Committee. All right, so House Bill 1960 is a bill that provides an annual appropriation of $350,000 to the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership. This appropriation would be administered by deed through the Adult Career Pathways Program and divided equally among six regional providers across the state. I will tell you that I was asked by Chair Baker to carry this bill, not knowing anything about Minnesota Family Resiliency. And after meeting with the leaders and just kind of understanding what the program is about, really felt a connection to them and felt like this was something important for us to be able to bring to the table as consideration. For over 45 years, the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership, formerly known as Displaced Home Worker Program, has been a trusted pre-employment and family stabilization program. It is the only program in the state specifically designed to help displaced homemakers address the unique barriers they face while trying to enter or re-enter the workforce as they navigate a very personal loss due to death, abandonment, divorce, disability of a spouse or partner. According to the most recent data available from DEED, of the program participants with a child support order, 75% are not receiving the support as ordered by the court. 96% of the program participants are women, and nearly all of are facing multiple barriers to self-sufficiency. And with that, I have more to say, but I'd really like to have our testifiers really share their experience with the program.
Thank you, Representative Mueller, for this. We've got Gene Keenan on Zoom. If you are ready to go, Gene, we are going to set the timer at, again, about 2 minutes. We appreciate that. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gene Keenan. Thank you for this opportunity. I would also like to thank Representative Mueller and the members of the committee who have supported our work over the years. We have worked very hard to be good stewards of funding that we have received. The Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership is a statewide network of six providers offering family stabilization and pre-employment services. The program has long-time stable leadership with directors having 20-plus years of experience. We are the only program specifically designed to support individuals who need to enter the workforce due to abandonment, divorce, disability, or death of a spouse or partner. It is our goal to interrupt the downward spiral that participants face after the loss of a family's primary wage earner. This wraparound program is offered at no cost to participants, all of whom are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guideline. Each individual works with a provider to develop a unique action plan. We help participants to develop essential transferable skills and effective job search strategies. Additionally, we provide direct support dollars to help participants overcome barriers that would impede their progress towards self-sufficiency, meaning things like a minor car repair, books for school, emergency child care. Most importantly, the program helps families to stabilize by providing holistic and trauma-informed care. Participants are eligible for services for up to 12 months or more when necessary. You see, 73% of program participants are survivors of intimate partner violence, and 28% enter the program unhoused. Last year, those who exited the program as employed did so at an average wage of $20.38 per hour. We are a program that has always been transparent and highly effective. 97% of participants successfully complete the program, meaning that they've met the goals they set at intake, which include employment and or continuing their education. At last calculation, the state realized a $26.89 to $1 return on its investment in the program by moving people away from public assistance. This program serves Minnesota's unseen unemployed or underemployed who may not otherwise receive any services and would be ineligible for unemployment insurance. Base funding for the program is authorized by statute and administered through deed from a portion of marriage license and divorce filing fees. This structure was designed specifically for this program.
Ms. Keenan, I'm sorry, if you could just wrap it up in about the next 15 seconds, I appreciate that.
I sure can, thank you. We are currently seeking to update that statute. However, because there will be a lag between collection and distribution of funds to the program, we are requesting this modest direct appropriation as bridge funding. We are asking for your support of House File 1960. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Keenan. Appreciate that. Next up is Ms. Kimberly Pilgrim. If you could introduce yourself and please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kimberly Pilgrim. At the request of Betty Rail, I'm here to share her story. She cannot be with us today because she was unable to take time off from work. I quote, I was a homemaker for 30 years and raised three children. One afternoon, my husband left for an appointment and he never returned. I was left isolated, grief-stricken, suicidal, and fearful. I did not have an income and had little experience driving a vehicle. I didn't even know how to put gas in my car. I had no community support, and my grown children lived out of state. I learned about the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership, so I made an appointment. I was very afraid, but I drove to the office. I was so afraid to go in, the director met me in the parking lot. I attended workshops that helped me manage grief, learn self-esteem, manage loss, life skills, and self-confidence. I also had the help of other participants who taught me how to put gas in my car and treated me as family. The program supported me with supportive services, car repairs, gas, clothing, and resources for food. At first, much of my time was spent on one-on-one preparation, and I was gaining strength. At 53 years old, I knew I had to do something. With individual career planning, I decided to enroll in college in the Administrative Assistant Program. I graduated from college with honors, and because I had gained such strength, I was fully prepared for employment. Within 3 months of graduation, I was interviewed and hired full-time with a livable wage with great benefits. I would have not made it without this program. I urge you to recognize its profound impact and continue funding this support and supporting this vital initiative. The people who benefit from this program are not just statistics. We are survivors, and we are proof that with the right resources, a second chance at life is possible. Thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you, Ms. Pilgrim, for sharing that with us. Representative Mueller, any further testifiers? I don't see any. Anyone in the audience want to speak to this bill? Seeing none, member questions? Seeing none, again, this is a bill that I've carried in the past. It's a very good group that does help a lot of really super people. So these are great stories. Closing comments, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. First, I really would like to thank Representative Scott and Representative Ryer, who are co-authors on the bill with me. And I've spent my entire life in education, trying to invest in young people, trying to invest in the next generation. And one of the things that after I became a legislator that I was, I had someone send me this quote, and it's something that I've carried with me since, that empowered women empower women. And I just feel very strongly about being able to invest in people who want to be able to have that second chance. One of the reasons why I went ahead and signed on to Representative Frazier's bill that we just heard. I want to see those who are being able to really want that next chance in life to be able to do that. What makes this program more than workforce development is its holistic and client-driven approach. And I want to make sure that these women, mostly women, who are in a situation that they couldn't imagine are able to be able to succeed and thrive. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would thank you with that and would ask that you would lay over the bill for future consideration.
Thank you so much. House File 1960 will be considered for a future bill. Thank you very much. And our final bill for the day, Chair Zhang, if you'd want to come forward. Welcome to one of the greatest committees ever, Chair Zhang. You were last year's chair. I had to give him some support. And again, it's good to see you back in the real working person's committee here. So, Chair Zhang, welcome. Please proceed with House File. The chair will move House File 1638 for future consideration. Two-year bill, Chair Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be back. And I know you saved the best for last.
That's right.
And so, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this important investment in Minnesota's nonprofit workforce. I also want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for being co-author so that this bill will have bipartisan support. I am honored to present this bill, which will allocate $250,000 from the Workforce Development Fund to support Equispace, a nonprofit center in St. Paul, as it provides critical resources to nonprofits across our state. As you all know, nonprofits make up about 14% of our taxpaying workforce, a significant and essential part of our economy. And just like other sectors, nonprofit organizations require professional development infrastructure and shared services to thrive. However, too often nonprofit leaders and their teams struggle to access these vital support. And so Equispace is meeting this need by providing workspaces, wraparound support services, and professional development tools that ensures nonprofit professionals have the resources necessary to serve the communities effectively. And with me today is a testifier who will share more. And if you have hard questions, ask her, not me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Klein, welcome to the committee. We've got about 2 to 3 minutes for your testimony. So please proceed after you introduce yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Sarah Klein, Executive Director of Equispace. Thank you, Chair Baker and members of the committee. Equispace is a resource hub that supports nonprofit organizations by offering affordable, high-functioning workspaces and essential operational support. We've created a collaborative environment where leaders and teams can share resources, knowledge, and expertise, helping organizations strengthen their operations and achieve their goals more effectively. By providing proximity to other nonprofits, we create efficiencies that allow small and mid-sized organizations to meet the same standards that larger organizations require despite having fewer resources. Equispace offers a range of critical services, including IT support, professional development, and shared meeting spaces, all designed to help nonprofits streamline their operations and better serve their communities. Importantly, Equispace helps reduce the risk of fraud, waste, and abuse by ensuring that leaders and teams have access to the resources they need to comply with local, state, and federal regulations. This enables organizations to maintain accountability, transparency, and efficiency in their work. Investing in Equispace is an investment in the future success of the groups and initiatives that strengthen the state. By providing the support and infrastructure these organizations need, we are helping them fulfill their missions more effectively, create jobs, and contribute to the economic well-being of our communities. Funding Equispace will lead to stronger, more sustainable organizations that are equipped to make a meaningful impact across the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Appreciate that. Anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Any members with any questions to the bill? Seeing none. Representative Zhang. I was hoping for some zingers, but I don't even see that today. But again, I know that I'm one that, again, am a co-author on this, and I do want to go out and see the space at some point to set up an appointment. I do want to kind of see that collaboration going on, so we'll do that sometime. Did I hear Representative Hussein? Did you have a question? No, okay. Representative Chair Zhang, why don't you give us our final comments on the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. As you recall, last biennial we did pass this bill in the House, but you know things don't get done over once it goes to the Senate, and so it's my hope that by approving this investment, we're making a strategic decision to support the sustainability and success of the organizations that serve Minnesotans every day. And I hope that the committee can support this funding request and help ensure that Equispace continues to provide essential services to our state's nonprofit workforce. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Chair Zhang for the bill. House File 1638 will be laid over for future consideration. Thank you so much for coming today, Mrs. Klein. Ms. Klein. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. Co-Chair Pinto, do you want to have any previews for the exciting day that we have lined up for tomorrow?
Indeed, Mr. Chair. Yes. So tomorrow is Youth Day. So we will have, I think we have eight bills listed. If we only have seven, we're going to be adding an eighth, but it'll be in the youth theme. I'm being told that they're all up. So we've got eight funding bills all relating to youth workforce development. And so that's a lot of bills to get through, but there are good things. So we'll be hearing about them, and then we'll continue conversations. Thank you, Chair.
Looking forward to that, Co-Chair Pinto. Thank you so much. With that, members, we are adjourned.